And I mean, these are all pretty low-end boxes. I mean, things that I'd really never recommend to clients. And I think some of them you could certainly characterize as end of life. And so mostly I just want to bring this to your attention because I think it's a prime example of why using consumer-grade wireless routers is a really bad choice these days, especially in the case that you're running a small business. I don't even recommend a consumer-grade wireless router anymore to residential clients because they're just not effective. They don't have a good life cycle. They have security vulnerabilities that go unpatched and unassessed. You don't have clear guidance on when the end of life, when the end of life for these things are. So there's just a whole bunch of issues. Like, for example, with this VPN filter malware vulnerability that's going on right now with a lot of these affected devices, we don't even know what all devices are actually affected. And I haven't read anything about these manufacturers looking at their existing still supported products and looking to find out whether or not they have this vulnerability. And the problem is that these wireless routers for the consumer market are not really designed to be security appliances. They're not. They're supposed to be stupid, simple, easy to use devices, and that's why the vast majority of them even support universal plug and play, otherwise known as UPnP, which pretty much in the IT security industry, UPnP is completely not allowed. I mean, if you were to obtain any sort of a business class security appliance, UPnP is not going to be allowed whatsoever. It's just not a functionality that is available because it's so horrific in terms of being a security problem. So if you do have one of these consumer grade wireless routers and you're using it for your small business, I would just characterize that as catastrophic. And I know for fact that there are organizations in this community that are supposed to be both HIPAA and PCI compliant that are using consumer grade wireless routers for their business. Now imagine you happen to be a consumer of that organization and you go in there with your credit card or your debit card, or you go in there to get your healthcare services. Well, that's pretty darn catastrophic because if they don't even have a business class security appliance that's being managed by a professional, then I can tell you that there is no way in heck that they are HIPAA or PCI compliant. So, what do you as a consumer do about it? I think it's rough. I think it's really rough because you can't exactly use the size of the organization as some sort of a delineator to decide whether or not they're competent. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on and on with stories about how absolutely massive corporations are just flamingly incompetent. I mean, Experian is probably the biggest example of that, right? Or I'm sorry, Equifax. I don't want to disparage Experian too much. It was Equifax. An interesting note on Equifax, I was reading Krebs on Security, and this is Brian Krebs' security blog, and he really spends a lot of time writing about the credit reporting bureaus and all of the identity theft and the privacy violation things. And he was recently talking about and published, he published about how there are all of these dirty, underhanded things going on where your entire life salary history, I kid you not, is housed at Equifax. And yeah, here's another ugly one, which is that even if you have gone to a service such as TransUnion's monthly subscription where it does allow you to put a credit freeze lock on all three credit reporting bureaus. There's actually a fourth one called Intronis, just so you know. But this has actually not stopped people from having their identity stolen and used to open new accounts for cell phone services. Oh my goodness, why is that? Well, the reason is because these cell phone providers, specifically it was AT&T, got together years ago with Equifax and decided to create their own telco consumer reporting, payment history system. So they didn't want to rely upon the three credit reporting bureaus. So they created their own treasure trove. Now, this is something that nobody knows about. I mean, almost nobody knows about this. So if you're trying to use credit lock freezes to prevent your identity from being utilized to open up new debt accounts or credit accounts that you would ultimately be liable for, you don't even have any idea about this. So the first one you need to know about is a website called The Work Number. And The Work Number is, again, your entire salary history for your entire life. I kid you not, someone can easily obtain this data. Employers, prospective employers will go there. And of course, they're using this data to try and find out how little they can get away with paying you. I'm just horrified and disgusted by these things. And so you should also go to this process of unsubscribing yourself or opting out of this stupid telco database as well. And I'll put up some links on this for you to read and pursue and hopefully go after improving your personal security there. But I also know that about this VPN filter problem, I will also post a link for that. You can check that out. All right, let's get back to the Verizon Investigations data breach team, where they were looking at the history of what happened in the year 2017 and writing a report on it. I have to absolutely admit that I do not like the format of this year's report. I thought the format that they used for last year's report was excellent. What they did last year is they had a little overview, they had some like summary items with their own opinions, their own, security analysis conclusions that they came out of from their analysis of the data. But the part that was spectacular is they ranked the breaches by type. And so, for example, all the ones, the breaches that were occurring due to, say, credential theft or something like that, they ranked them. And then they presented them in that order. And then in each case, they would present one or two specific, very, very specific examples of what the situation was, obviously not revealing any personally identifiable information of any of these organizations that were involved in the breaches. But they were very specific in how the breach happened. And the reason that I felt that this was absolutely crucial is because, as a person charged with preventing these issues, you could look at the way in which these breaches had occurred and then looked at your own risk mitigation strategies that you had in place for the organizations that you support, and then say, aha, yes, well, this technology that we use here, that would have prevented this breach from occurring. And then you can basically use that format as a self-check assessment that says, am I invulnerable to this problem? Would I have been breached? No, I wouldn't have been breached. Well, anyways, they didn't take that format this year, and I felt that that was really lacking. They really didn't go over any specific details as to how these breaches occurred, so it wasn't really that helpful. All right. Anyway, so what was helpful was strictly the understanding of the statistical magnitude of the types of breaches. So they didn't go into these, specific details, but they did at least say, okay, for example, 22% of all breaches were caused due to credential theft. Well, 22% of all breaches is actually a pretty sizable thing. And then they said 13% of all breaches were caused by phishing. Well, phishing is this whole business email compromise stuff that I was talking about on the last show. So if you combine those two, you now have 35% of all breaches. So you could effectively reduce the threat profile to your organization by 35% if you focused on addressing and mitigating credential theft issues as well as phishing and business email compromise. So yay, right? I mean, there is some usefulness to come out of this from the perspective you could look at it and say, well, let's use multi-factor authentication everywhere where we can. And then let's use a product like Trend Micro's hosted email security or Trend Micro's cloud app security. I generally don't use both of those at the same time because they cover different scenarios, but they do similar things at the email layer. And that's, of course, what we're talking about here is business email compromise. Now, the other interesting piece is DNS Watch, which is part of the phishing mitigation. And I had talked about that last time, where you can mitigate phishing simply by always protecting the endpoints with a security appliance where the phishing websites are being blocked. All right, so let's move on to some of these other kind of insightful statistics. So where an internal actor was involved in the breach 26% of the time, it was someone with system admin privileges that caused the breach. Well, that's really interesting. So 26% of the time where an internal actor was involved, it was the system admin. And the big takeaway for this is that the system admins have to be extra, extra, super, super vigilant. And I think the vast majority of IT professionals are just not as vigilant as they should be. And I know you're probably a little shocked to hear me say that. Well, when you look at the managed services industry as an example, the managed services industry, by and large, is not using multi-factor authentication. And then you have large teams of individuals that are all using exactly the same credential. Well, you can't use multi-factor authentication when you're using exactly the same credential. And if you have 50 people using exactly the same credential, and maybe a number of those people actually work for some outsourced contractor, how do you actually roll that password? What is the mechanism whereby the person who left the organization's access is now revoked? Or, I guess I would even argue, why do you need to have 50 people that have admin access to your stuff? It's ludicrous as far as I'm concerned. That is a ludicrous figure. I mean, when I look at a massive corporation that has 13,000 users, they generally do not have more than eight server global admins. And they generally do not have more than eight network admins. So if it only takes like 16 people in total with total admin access for an organization of 13,000 users, then I'm pretty darn sure you can safely say you really don't need to have more than four people that have admin access to your organization that has 400 employees. And if you have, 50 employees, do you need more than two people that have admin access to your systems? I don't think so. And so again, this is one of the massive, massive problems that exists in the managed services industry. And most small business owners are getting sucked into this delusion and illusion that managed services is the way to go. But they just don't know what questions to be asking. I mean, out of a bunch of managed services IT consulting firms that I know of, I can really only name two that I think are doing it appropriately. One of them is an org over in Michigan who has a very similar business model to what we have at Quality Plus Consulting, where we use teams of two on an account, on a customer account, and then each individual has their own individual credentials. And these credentials are not shared. So if somebody was to leave the organization, those credentials can be quite easily turned off without affecting anyone else. And then this other organization I know is kind of at the northwestern side of Wisconsin, and they use a pretty sophisticated and expensive credential management software package that will actually roll the credentials and provide just-in-time access. So, I mean, that's an indication of somebody who actually does take security seriously. I frankly think it's a lot less expensive for everyone if they would just do like what we do, where you just assign a team of two and that's it, and nobody else has access to that customer's stuff. So this whole essence of restricting restricting who has admin access is a big deal. And then beyond that, you need to ensure that whoever does have admin access is taking that admin access extremely seriously, and that they are using things like multi-factor authentication. Now, you're never going to be able to use MFA on circumstances like a switch. You could do things like Radius, but that's not very practical in the SMB market. What you can do is use what's called access control restrictions to ensure that someone could only initiate a connection to that switch from an already trusted device. So that in itself is a mechanism of multi-factor authentication, which is exactly what you should be doing in terms of connecting to servers or connecting to perimeter security appliances, right? Where you don't necessarily have MFA, you need to find another way to ensure that there's another set of effective authentication sitting in front of that. It absolutely can be done. I've been doing this for over 20 years. It can be done. You just have to choose to do it. You just have to care to do it. And nobody said that security is a convenience factor, but I would argue every moment of every day, of every week, of every year, that the inconvenience of having your logon process take 10 more seconds or 5 more seconds is way less painful than having a breach, and you know, Lord only knows what the implications of that is, because at that point you've totally lost control and the bad guys now have control. So as moving on to some other statistics here, we have 62% of the time organized crime was the external breach actor. And this ties into this whole idea that what are they after? Well, they're after your financials, but there's some other really interesting bits, which is that the other data that they are really strongly after is medical data. And they are very strongly after your employee data, because that is W-2 data. What they are doing with this W-2 data is filing false IRS tax returns. Yeah, that's what they're doing. You didn't see that coming, huh? And all of this is all about, you know, organized crime. In fact, some of the things that's been revealed in the last few years is that organized crime was getting so much heat for drug dealing and things like that, that they moved into what they considered to be a, you know, lesser heat sort of crime, which was things like Medicare fraud, Medicaid fraud, SSI disability fraud, and of course, stealing W-2 information and filing false tax returns, where your tax return refund then goes to some address in Georgia. And the reason I say Georgia is because there was this infamous IRS case where something in excess of 35,000 tax returns were sent to the same address, were filed at the same address at a house in Georgia. So I'm sorry, you have to look at something like that and wonder what happened to the brains of the people at the IRS who were putting together the system around the electronic filings, right? Where's this whole aspect of the electronic filings where they say, I think at the point in time that we got more than 15 people who filed a tax return at the same address, we ought to like not allow that address to be used for a tax return filing anymore, and somebody needs to go investigate that. And you know, maybe 15 isn't the right number, but I got a hard time believing that you're going to have more than 15 income earners who are filing individual tax returns all at the same physical address. Anyways, interesting things to think about. So 62% of the time, organized crime was the actor involved in an external breach. And 32% of all breaches involved point of sale assets. And these included literally the second and third top categories. So the number one top asset involved in a breach was a database server. Well, that's not real surprising, is it now? I mean, all these database servers are just treasure troves of super, super valuable information that they can do all kinds of, you know, heinous activities with. So 25% of all compromised data was medical data. And that actually confirmed my own observations where I've got a lot of interaction in the medical industry, and I have yet to actually see one healthcare-related organization that I would characterize as truly being HIPAA compliant. Now, I'm not talking about CVS or Walgreens, right? I don't walk into some big organization like that. However, I can tell you that I've audited some hospitals and some extremely large medical institutions that are private clinics owned by a bunch of docs that say have like 300 employees. Now, that's a fairly, you know, significant organization. And to tell you that these organizations have either no security, effectively almost no security, or they aren't even remotely HIPAA compliant, not in the least bit, and they seem to not have any desire to do so, that should just horrify you. So, you know, the interesting little thought about that is I don't really genuinely think there's any teeth in the HITECH Act at all, and there's an awful lot in the HITECH Act that is just not talked about. You see all of this stuff being published about HIPAA and less and less and less about high tech. And a lot of the stuff on high tech is just not as specific as I think it should be. And there's no audits being done. If I was to change the way that the government is doing things, I mean, you know, in general, I don't think that government intervention actually helps in any way. But in the case of protecting consumer information and health information and consumer privacy, I think they do have to set regulations for these things. But those regulations have absolutely no teeth if there's no audits. And an audit really would not be that big of a deal to do. But there seems to be no staff at HHS who have this on their radar. I haven't heard of HHS audits happening at all. I couldn't even name you one entity that's gone through an HHS audit on a proactive basis. I mean, not to say that they don't come in and, you know, look to ream somebody out after a breach has been discovered. Sure, you know, they want to get in on it because then they're like, yeah, we can pick up our government fines now and we can make money off of this, you know. But on a proactive basis, I don't see them going in there. There's much more regulation and auditing that goes on in the financial services industry. Okay, well, anyways, on the next thing here was about breach timelines. And this was all very, very interesting stuff because talking about the phases of breach timelines, you have data exfiltration, you have the discovery process, and then you have the containment process. So first, let's talk about the discovery process in a breach. This was averaging months. So out of all of the incidents that they looked at, it took months, multiple months, in order to even identify that a breach had occurred. Now, contrast that with the time that it took to start the data exfiltration out of the organization. That was literally minutes. So then the containment was within, say, roughly between days, weeks, and months. It kind of tapers off. After, and this was after breach discovery. not after the initial data exfiltration started. Right? So the bottom line here is that as soon as there is a breach of any kind, the data exfiltration is, I mean, it's happening in minutes. So it's certainly in less than a day. So if you don't have total automation in place, I don't know how you're going to respond to that. And a good example I could give you of that is I had a client who had finished doing a network re-architecture project for, and everything was hardened and secured. And in these processes, you always find out later on about the naughty little things that are going on in an environment because they didn't know what was going on before. When you have no network visibility into what's going on, you don't even know that you're breached, right? Well, so what we found was that the security appliance had proactively stopped a brute force password attack against a domain controller. It identified the unit that was the perpetrator of the breach, right? Of the attack. And then, of course, it stopped it. And then it reported on it. So it alerted us and told us that this thing had happened and that it had blocked it. Now, that is your ideal scenario, right? The ideal scenario is where the automation blocks the bad doo-doo, but it still brings it to your awareness so that you are able to go check things out later on. So your protected asset was protected. It was not breached. The attack was stopped, but you're still identified of who the attacker was, whether it be a PC or whatever it is. You're still identified as to who the attacker is so that you can then go investigate it. Now, in a lot of cases, these are external attackers, and what can you do about external attackers? You don't have any control over that. But certainly if it's a device on your own network, boy, you better get on that right away. But none of this can happen if you do not have a properly architected network and you don't have these security policies in place at the network layer that have this automation coupled with the appropriate logging and the appropriate reporting and the appropriate real-time notifications for these things. So I've got some other things that I think that you should know about, but I think it's probably best prudent to cover these in actually a part three show on this, because there's actually some really good things here. And by all means, send me your feedback on this and tell me if you like this year's format of the Verizon breach report versus the old year, the prior year. And I do have these published out on the website, so you can feel free to download the report and read it for yourself.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Since 1931, Piasecki Althaus has provided unmatched, compassionate service and are dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. 262-658-4101.
Support for WGTD comes from Lemon Street Gallery. The Introduction to the Potter's Wheel class will take place June 19th, 1 to 3 p.m., and June 26th, 1 to 3 p.m., for young adults 13 and up. Build confidence using a clay studio. Call 262-605-4745 for more. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Parkside hosts an interpersonal workplace communication online training for professionals looking to better their workplace collaboration. The online module takes place June 11th through July 20th. Visit uwp.edu. Support for WGTD comes from Lemon Street Gallery. The Pline Air Painting class will be held Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays for 3 weeks starting July 10th from 1 to 3 p.m. for children 7 to 12 years old. Students will meet at Lemon Street but paint in Union Park. Call 605-4745.
This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in South